Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Mara Liasson, making sure Ken is on his best behavior.
Yes, Ron Elving is actually in Libya. He's taken control. He's the new head. He's Colonel Ron Elving. Muammar Gaddafi is gone.
He's gone.
What do you think?
I think it's a great day for the Libyan people. And it was inevitable. And now that it's happened, the president can say he helped it happen because he provided air support to the rebels.
The political question is there political benefits for the president?
Well, I think this, along with the death of Osama bin Laden and the other terrorist leaders that this administration has taken out or captured, are all good things for the president. I don't think they matter very much in an election where the economy is the overwhelming number one issue, but it's certainly better than having those things not happen. It means that it's just one more area where the Republicans won't be attacking him on. Sure, it's good for the president. I think foreign policy and national security are a kind of threshold criteria, qualification for any commander-in-chief. I don't think it changes the dynamic of the election very much.
I mean, that's like talking about 1991. Was the Persian Gulf War a great victory for the first President Bush? Yes. Did it matter in 1992? No.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Okay, so what does matter is the economy, and we did see a little interesting fracas go on in Las Vegas.
Yes, and we're now in the real trench warfare phase. Nobody's getting a free pass. For the first time, Mitt Romney...
Which means, do you think that Mitt Romney was getting a free pass all along?
I think he was getting more or less of a free pass. I think one of the most remarkable things, there's pre-Las Vegas and post-Las Vegas.
Right.
Pre-Las Vegas, one of the most remarkable things was how easy a ride the front runner Mitt Romney was getting. All sorts of people rose up to challenge him in the polls.
Michelle Bachmann,
Rick Perry, Herman Cain. But it didn't seem to matter. He was chugging along with his 25% support. That doesn't sound like it's that great, but it never went down.
Or up.
But he was not being damaged by the other candidates. They were all vying to be the conservative alternative to Romney, and none of them was consolidating the conservative opposition to him.
Right, but doesn't it interest you in the sense that if everybody is trying to rise and ultimately falling, Mitt Romney's numbers have not improved.
They haven't improved, but...
We're talking about the inevitability of Mitt Romney, and yet we're still talking about 25% in the polls.
There's two ways to look at this. One is Romney has a ceiling. He can't go beyond that.
But he has a lot of flaws.
He has a ceiling, meaning he has a lot of flaws. He has a ceiling, and you could look at that as saying he can't go any higher. But in fact, when you look at his support, it's mostly positive. He's everybody's second choice. People are not saying they...
first choice, too.
Yes, he's 25% first choice, but there isn't a huge number of Republicans saying, I won't vote for him under any circumstances. So I think the Romney campaign was figuring at some point the conservative vote stops being split and some of these candidates start dropping out by attrition after people start voting and Romney starts getting some more of that support. Or if they all stay in and split the anti-Romney vote, you can actually win with 25%.
Right. I mean, we saw that with John McCain in 2008. For the longest time, he was considered not a front runner and not the inevitable nominee. But when you had conservatives like Mike Huckabee and Mitt Romney and Fred Thompson, it helped John McCain win the nomination.
And one of the most mystifying things about this race so far has been there hasn't been someone who's been able to become the conservative alternative to Romney. As you said, all sorts of people auditioned for the role. But in Las Vegas, what we saw was Rick Perry coming back to life and leveling some attacks against Mitt Romney, which I do think rattled Romney for the first time. Up until now, he's been mostly above the fray in these debates. He's looked polished. He's come out clearly the winner on points, at least. But I think that Las Vegas might have changed that.
A perfect example of how Mitt Romney was trying to establish himself as above the fray is in the previous debate when he had the opportunity to take on one of his opponents. Did he go after Rick Perry? No. He gave a softball, silly question to Michelle Bachmann. How would you improve the economy?
Because in Hanover, which is when that's the debate where that happened, Rick Perry had collapsed.
Right.
Rick Perry was a non-factor for Mitt Romney. However, we know all along that Rick Perry was the only candidate in the anti-Romney group that had the resources to challenge him. Because he'd raised $17 million, he had the ability to put up ads, and you did see them take on each other in Las Vegas. And now we are reverting to what a lot of people thought this race was going to be all along. It could become a two-man race again, Romney versus Perry.
Do we think that just because you're raising a lot of money, if you're raising a lot of money as allegedly Rick Perry is. And I say allegedly because I think there's a lot of expenditures that they haven't reported yet. And given the fact that in the numbers, in the polls, his numbers have collapsed in many, many states, will he still be raising something in the next quarter?
These are all very good questions.
But at the same time, what I think of 1996 and Phil Gramm raising all this money, a record-breaking amount of money, and yet ultimately he was a non-factor on the campaign trail. Yes, Rick Perry can put up all the negative ads he wants, and he will, and he's a ferocious campaigner, but on the debate stage, I thought he was less than effective. I think the last four were abysmal. The good news, of course, is that we're not going to see a debate for another month.
That's right. I think that what Perry did, he didn't turn in a fabulous performance, but he was... At least he didn't seem like he was sleeping on the stage. He came to play, and he leveled some attacks against Romney, and he did rattle him. Now, we have to wait and see what happens.
They were booing him, by the way.
Well, first of all, the crowd was definitely pro-Romney. I think we can say that. I don't think that Rick Perry did himself that much good in Las Vegas, but he definitely dinged Romney the first time. That's what I'm saying. So he has the potential to resurrect himself, but he has dug a terribly deep hole for himself. He has to climb out of it. As you said, he might not have as much money as we think, and money alone isn't going to do it for him.
As President Phil Gramm can tell you.
And what he has to do now is do all of the things that he, for some mysterious reason, neglected to do in the first 8 weeks he was in the race. How about laying out his conservative vision for America? Now, he is next week giving a speech about the flat tax. He's going to lay out an economic plan. Mitt Romney has a 59-point plan, which is mostly Republican boilerplate. It's not bold or a departure. Perry has the potential to lay out a plan that will excite the same conservative base that was drawn to Herman Cain's 999 plan, a very radical, bold scrapping of the tax code.
Of course, Steve Forbes did raise that same thing in the 1996 campaign and got him nowhere, too.
Republican Party is a different party now.
Yes, and Rick Perry is a far superior campaigner than Steve Forbes. But going back to 999, in the first 20 minutes of the debate, everybody seemed to take it because we went into Las Vegas as Herman Cain being the new flavor.
Yes, we thought that all the attacks were... Yes, conventional wisdom was everybody is going to have to attack Cain because he's standing in the way of them becoming the conservative alternative Romney, and they did.
The story for the first 20 minutes of the debate was how that the numbers of Herman Cain's 999 plan were not adding up at all.
Herman Cain's job in Las Vegas was to show that he could be a serious candidate, not just a populist crowd pleaser. And I don't think he met that threshold.
I don't think either, especially when earlier, right prior to the debate, he talked about an electrified barbed wire fence between the U.S. and Mexico and having a moat with alligators. And he later said, that was a joke.
I think that's why, by the end of the debate, it was Romney versus Perry.
Before we leave Herman Cain, is he, as some people wonder, is he really running for president or is he giving speeches at $25,000 a pop and he's promoting his book? Is that what he's doing?
That's a very good question because look where he was last week. He wasn't in Iowa and he wasn't in Nevada. He wasn't in South Carolina or New Hampshire either. He was in Tennessee.
Right.
So you have to think that he certainly doesn't have a campaign in place with the resources and the plan to win these early states. He just doesn't.
Now, Rick Perry, of course, went after Mitt Romney on something we heard 4 years ago, the fact that Romney hired a landscaping company that, unbeknownst to Romney, hired illegal immigrants.
The idea that you stand here before us and talk about that you're strong on immigration is on its face the hive of hypocrisy.
You know, immigration is the issue that Mitt Romney decided to use first against Rick Perry. Mitt Romney doesn't have a whole lot of opportunities to be to the right of someone like Rick Perry, but he found one, immigration, and he attacked him for this in-state tuition plan that Perry had passed with overwhelming support in Texas. So Perry fired back on the same issue, and I think the Romney camp was thinking, every negative about Mitt Romney is old. Everybody knows this stuff. It's built into his stock price, so to speak. But Perry went back and got old information, you know, this story about him hiring the landscaping company with illegals, and he used it. And what he got from Romney was he knocked him off his polished pedestal for at least a couple of minutes.
I'm looking forward to finding your facts on that because that just doesn't...
I'll tell you what the facts are.
Rick, again,
you had the
Rick,
more, you,
I'm speaking,
your newspaper,
I'm speaking,
the newspaper.
I'm speaking.
Romney was flustered. He also said a very memorable line that I think will come back to haunt him.
So we went to the company and we said, look, you can't have any illegals working on our property. I'm running for office for Pete's sake. I can't have illegals.
That was remarkable. I mean, I think as I was sitting and watching that part, I said, he didn't really say that, did he? He actually did say that.
He actually did say that.
But he also put his hand on Perry. He you know, he violated that space that you're not supposed to encroach in a debate.
And I think that's what Perry was looking for. This was a very mano-a-mano personal thing that happened on the stage. And the two of them don't like each other at all. And Perry wanted to get under Romney's skin.
And I
think he succeeded. Now, where does he go from here? You can't win just with that. You have to have policies and a platform and a conservative vision that's going to excite the conservative base. And for Perry, he's now starting at an incredible disadvantage. When you think that Rick Perry, just because he was Rick Perry, started at the top of the field. The minute he got in, he was the front runner, and he squandered it. It's very hard to make up ground that you have lost through unforced errors. But that's what he has to do, and he's going to try. He gave a speech on energy that seemed to be kind of playing to type, Texas governor wanting to drill.
Create jobs.
Well, yes, that's important too. But now he's going to give this flat tax speech, and we'll see what he does in the weeks ahead. As you said, they have a respite from the debates. He gets to do the things that he says, Perry says, he's better at than debating, which is retail campaigning and giving speeches. And he is very charismatic. And we'll see if he can make up some of the ground he lost.
That's before we dismiss the rest of the field completely. I thought Rick Santorum was unusually aggressive, lashing into Romney also on Romney Care. And you see that, you know, Rick Santorum shaking his head, no, 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 you're wrong. Rick Santorum became part of the debate dialogue.
Yes, but I don't think any of the other candidates matter in terms of their ability to be the eventual nominee. I think what they do is they can provide ammunition against Romney. They can weaken him if some of these attacks actually have an effect. Or in the case of Herman Cain, they can provide a kind of buffer between Romney and the other candidates. As long as Herman Cain is the parking place for anti-Romney conservative sentiment in the Republican electorate, it's not going to one of the other candidates. But I still think Romney and Perry are the two big contenders.
Well, we've identified who the candidates are. Now we have to find out when these actual contests will occur. And the biggest news of the week is that, one, Nevada announced that they will have their caucuses on Saturday, January 14th. Iowa followed up by saying they'll have their caucuses on Tuesday, January 3rd. And that puts New Hampshire in this very weird position because state law says they have to have a separation of 7 days after their contest. And of course, by Nevada moving up to January 14th, Bill Gardner, the Secretary of State, said, well, look, maybe we'll have the contest in the New Hampshire primary in December if we have to, because what Nevada did is just destroying everything.
It's really an extraordinary spectacle. We have to say this all was started by Florida.
Florida moving up to January 31st, right? And then South Carolina moving up to January 21st, and then Nevada following, exactly. Now, all the candidates, of course, are calling for boycotts of Nevada. Now, there are two reasons for that. One, they want to curry favor with New Hampshire. John Huntsman has moved his family, his whole life, his whole campaign to New Hampshire. If he doesn't win New Hampshire, he's finished. I think that's obvious. That is the reason why he boycotted the Las Vegas debate. But this Saturday, the Nevada GOP is meeting, and they're going to perhaps reconsider, because they're getting terrible press. Everybody seems to be against him. I suspect they're going to move back at least to January 17th, which will give New Hampshire the opportunity to have their primary January 10th, and it'll be a one-week delay.
Yeah. You know, New Hampshire has it written in law that they have to be at least a week, I think 7 or 8 days, before the next, quote, similar contest.
Right.
Now, Nevada's a caucus. New Hampshire is a primary, so there's a little wiggle room in how Bill Gardner might interpret that. But New Hampshire is very determined to preserve its first-in-the-nation status, and I think they will. And that's why they were talking about going to December if necessary.
There also seems to be some indication that now, I mean, who knows what the fallout from the Vegas debate is, but at least looking at the polls, Perry has not helped himself. Cain is still up there. It gives Romney an opportunity to make a big move in Iowa.
Yes. Romney has had a very unpleasant experience with Iowa. He won the straw poll last time only to lose the caucus there to Mike Huckabee. This time, I think he was going to not compete. He was figuring, look, whoever comes out of Iowa will be dismissed. It'll be a Michelle Bachmann. It'll be some conservative social issue candidate that has no chance of getting the nomination, so who cares? But if he has a real challenger in Rick Perry, for instance, he's going to have to really compete in Iowa, and he could do very well there. He has the resources. He's been around long enough to create an organization. Having these states go early advantages Mitt Romney. He's the one with the organization on the ground. He's been at this long enough to do this. Anybody with the money and organization who's been able to organize early will be advantaged by the calendar moving up.
Perhaps, but you could also make the case that Rick Perry coming from the South, of course Herman Cain is a South too, but Rick Perry coming from the South could be very strong in South Carolina and Florida.
Yes, if he gets his act together.
Right. The thing to remember, of course, is that if Romney makes a big bid in Iowa and fails, that could be really detrimental. Remember what John McCain did. He basically skipped Iowa in both 2000 and 2008 and wound up winning in New Hampshire shortly after both times.
And I think that's what Romney originally thought he would do. This is a very tricky game. If you start competing in Iowa, you have to either be serious or not. If you're serious, you're going to be held to the bar. Did you win Iowa or not? If you don't compete there, then it's not going to be held against you. It's very, very tricky. What he has to worry about is if somebody comes out of Iowa with real momentum. Mike Huckabee didn't have real momentum because he didn't have the resources to go beyond Iowa.
And he was not going to be strong in New Hampshire anyway.
Right. And Michelle Bachmann would have been, I think, in a similar situation way back when she was the alternative to Romney. Perry, however, if he gets his act together, could use Iowa for a real boost if he could win there. So I think the Romney campaign is dipping their big toe in the water of Iowa. He's there this week. Campaigning in the western part of the state, which is traditionally more conservative socially.
Some people looked at what happened on the stage in Las Vegas and said the real winner was President Obama. What do you think of that?
I think that to the extent the Republican primary becomes a circular firing squad and not just a bunch of guys beating up on the president, which it was previously, of course that helps the president for the moment. And if the conversation inside the Republican Party becomes all about illegal immigrants instead of about jobs and the economy, that also helps the president. But I think, you know, we're just talking about one debate here, and that kind of trend would have to go on for a long time to really advantage Obama.
Before we have any of these presidential contests, which most likely will begin January 3rd in Iowa, we have this Saturday Bobby Jindal running for a second term in Louisiana and not much opposition.
No, he'll be reelected, and that will be that, and then we'll all wonder if he's going to be a vice presidential possibility or not.
What's fascinating about this is that, first of all, I think for the first time in history, certainly in memory, the Democrats have not put up any kind of candidate at all. There's a school teacher by the name of Tara Hollis, who seems to be the alternative to Bobby Jindal, but she has no money, no organization, no endorsements, although she has some union backing. But Bobby Jindal, remember, he got onto the national stage with a less than inspiring response to President Obama's address to Congress, and he was kind of mocked for that in 2009. But he has $6 million in the bank. He's possible running mate, possible cabinet, possible opponent to Mary Landrieu in 2014. In other words, he seems to have, you know, tremendous future. And I think the thing to really watch on Saturday is who wins the Republican nomination for lieutenant governor, especially if they think that Jindal won't be around that long in that position. But the fact that there's no Democrat of any
stature in Louisiana,
right, the first time they ever elected a Republican to the governorship is 1979, Dave Treen. The first time they ever elected a Republican to the Senate was David Vitter in 2004. So Republican victories in Louisiana are fairly new, and yet here they are, the Democrats are nowhere to be found.
Yeah, I mean, a lot has changed in Louisiana. The population has changed. The politics of the South has changed. Louisiana was probably one of the last dominoes to fall. But yeah, the trend is going Republican in that part of the country, and Louisiana isn't immune to it.
If the demographics and the politics of Louisiana are changing, I think the politics of Wisconsin certainly are changing as well. Scott Walker wins election 2010, routs the Democrats, part of a big Republican victory. Ron Johnson beats Russ Feingold, big Republican victory in Wisconsin. Now Scott Walker, his numbers have been in the toilet for the longest time. The recall against Scott Walker officially begins November 15th.
Right. They have 60 days to collect 540,000 signatures to put the recall election on the ballot.
That's great.
If they can get that, if his opponents can get that in May, he'll stand for a recall election.
Against an opponent. Now, the problem for the Democrats in Wisconsin is they don't have anybody yet. Russ Feingold said he's not going to run for any office in 2012. They don't have somebody to put up against him. I think right now, they're just banking on anti-Scott Walker sentiment, and it's very strong among the unions and the Democrats and the liberal groups. So they might get the 540,000 signatures. I don't know whether
But I think it'll be very hard to replace him with someone else. There might be big sentiment to recall him, but this is not an election where you just vote on the recall of Scott Walker. You actually there is going to be a choice. You know, the thing that's interesting, Scott Walker was just an example of the incredible Republican wave that swept the Midwest, the industrial heartland, very important electoral states, states that President Obama needs to win, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. In a lot of these states, and Wisconsin is a perfect example, the governors are now very unpopular. What does that mean for 2012? Does it mean that there's been such a backlash to them that's going to energize the Democratic base and help the president in these states? Or does it mean that just having a Republican governor means that the political infrastructure that governors can control is so powerful that it's going to help Republicans get out the vote and win those states in the presidential election?
I mean, a lot of people are saying that, but of course we saw for many years when John Engler was governor of Michigan, could he help Republicans win the White House? No. We had Republican governors in Wisconsin, and Democrats won the state too. So I think their ability to carry their state for their presidential ticket are overrated. But of course, I'd rather have if I were a Republican running for president, I'd rather have a Republican in the state capitol than not.
Right. And it's interesting because some of these governors' numbers are as bad or worse than President Obama's numbers are in those states.
And two states where the president was campaigning this week, Virginia and North Carolina, two states he unexpectedly carried in 2008, his numbers are far weaker today than they were 4 years ago.
Yeah, and that shows you what a very narrow, difficult path the president has to get the 270 electoral votes he needs this time. He won handily last time in the Electoral College. He won all sorts of states that, as you said, the Democrats hadn't won before. But now he's going to have to figure out what does he do if he can't get Ohio or Florida or Pennsylvania, the big states that Democrats have fought for in the past. Can he cobble together some kind of a electoral victory with the Mountain West and North Carolina and Virginia, which seem really difficult states for him to win this time?
The last poll I saw in Florida, he had 49% disapproval. And again, Florida is another state that he carried unexpectedly in 2008.
I think it's going to be really hard. I mean, it just shows you what an uphill climb they have.
And I suspect we'll be talking about this before the next podcast. But that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Mara Liasson.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. I want